Development will come to order. Representative Briner moves the minutes of
March 13th.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right.
We take bribes.
Mr. Chair, I just want you to note that you always claim that we in the suburban districts are in the pockets of Minneapolis.
Yes.
That we're offering something to you. And I hope, you know, with you sitting behind me in the chamber, that you don't use it to throw it at me.
Well, Representative Newton, a candy bar doesn't quite offset the $20 million you're trying to steal. Or did I lessen the amount? I think I was only way under what you're actually trying to steal. Does somebody want to move House File 2691?
Please.
You must not be.
Please.
I'll move 2691.
Are you stealing everybody's money?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File.
Thank you. Representative Briner moves House File 2691 to re-refer it to Education Finance.
Thank
Representative Newton, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have an amendment. It's the A1 amendment, and I'd appreciate if we could amend this bill to put it in the order that I would like.
Representative Briner moves the A1 amendment to put it in the form that the author likes or wants. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Go ahead, Representative.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, this bill as amended calls for an evaluation of the Early Learning Scholarship Program, sets a date for reports, and it establishes a registration process for the program. With me today, I have Steve Kerr from Monongahela School District and Jim Grathwall from
Minneapolis.
Make sure he gets some candy. And they would like to testify to the bill.
Sorry, what was Kerr?
Kerr, Steve Kerr.
K-E-R-R?
Correct.
Okay, Mr. Kerr, go ahead.
Chair Mulray, I appreciate that Representative Newton sweetened the deal for us a little bit. Appreciate that on his part. I think my testimony would be brief and to the point, and that is that we are experiencing some difficulties with the scholarships as a school-based program, and there's two parts of it. One, we'd like to do an evaluation of that to see is this the most effective way to fund the school-based programs with the scholarships. The second is the amendment component of it. The amendment component, what we are proposing is that we provide the ability for local programs to use their own processes and procedures to determine the eligibility of the scholarship recipients. Obviously, school districts use free and reduced kinds of measures all the time and have databases and systems set up to do that. Our records are, our financials are subject to audit and available to the public on an annual basis. And we have procedures for reaching out to our families and registering them for our programs. We would prefer to use those procedures instead of working through a third-party vendor, and believe it would be in the interest of the state if we could eliminate the third-party vendor and the 8% we paid the third-party vendor and have that money go directly to families that we would experience. To give you a reference point for the kind of experience that we've had in our school district with the scholarships, we were notified that we were eligible for scholarships as a school district in Anoka Hennepin. We went through the process of an application, which the first phase of the redundancies that we experienced was it was asking for much of the same data that we already submit for our school readiness plans. From there, we worked to identify our families who were eligible for this scholarship program, worked with them to complete a 9-page application. These are families that we're working with that are high poverty and ELL families and families that have students with special needs, learning needs. In some cases, we have to make home visits to complete those applications and work with those families to get them successfully completed. We then send those into a vendor for approval. The vendors would send those back if they were incomplete, if a family forgot their middle initial, if they didn't have their cell phone, if they had a cell phone, but if they didn't have those kinds of items, they were sent back. So we got to go back and forth and work with the families in some cases 2 and 3 times in order to get an application complete and approved for purposes of creating a cash flow, if you will, to offer services and programs. I would tell you in the Okehennepin District, the first dollar that flowed across our doorstep was the end of the third week in February. I was told by my staff as I left today, we have received 30% of the funds that we're eligible for here in March. The purpose of some of what we were going to do with the funding was to expand classroom services and also to put in some additional support services for families and students who would have special learning needs. An example would be a classroom in which we would knew there was two special ed students, but as we worked with the students, there were seven unidentified children who were in the class that had special learning needs. And we had hoped to use some of those scholarship dollars to infuse some additional support into those classrooms to support those kinds of situations that occur all the time for us in classrooms and work with those children. So for us, we've been running into what I'd say a consistent redundancy of processes, and many of the processes resemble, not that it's bad, but childcare processes and not processes that are aligned with school district procedures and policies for tracking finance and for tracking students and for reporting students and the things that we do as normal business in our school districts. With that, I'll end. Thank you.
Mr. Grathwall, are you supporting something that Representative Newton is doing?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Grathwall, and I'm very grateful to Representative Newton for bringing this bill forward and bringing it forward with a bag of candy. And I find nothing wrong with the suburbs being in the pocket of Minneapolis. I really don't. Oh, I meant that in another way, perhaps. Mr. Chair, to the bill, I'm here also testifying as a supporter of the Mini Minds Coalition and of the scholarships. I think what we're seeing here is that implementation has been suboptimal, less than optimal. And I think you can say that about a lot of things. I know my kids say that a lot about me. But you win a 400-meter race by running your legs fast, running your individual legs fast and passing the baton successfully over the course of the track three times. I think what we've set up is a system where we're having way more baton passes than you need, and there's a lot of baton dropping going on. It's March 18th. We've been serving students, about 66 so far of the 124 that we were allocated by MDE. Since October, actually it built up over time. We've submitted, filled out 9-page applications, submitted those to the department, done home visits, and we still haven't seen any resources, any of the scholarships flow in. And actually the fact that the MPS hasn't received resources as of today isn't a problem in so much as our cash flow. We're big. We can handle that. But let's just agree that that's suboptimal. I think there's a lot of back office communication that we could do between systems, DHS, MDE, MCHA, SHIP, all the other state assistance programs that would allow us to do this more efficiently, effectively. The process we have is, I think, inefficient for the work that we're doing. We run four-year-old kindergarten programs, four-year-old pre-kindergarten programs, that deliver their graduates, and they're targeted to be the low-income students of color and ELL students. They arrive in kindergarten from that program 82% kindergarten ready. That's an effective program and a great use of scholarship resources. It would be a good idea to make it more accessible to the students. We have like 900 students on the waiting list, 1,200 students in that program. We're working that waiting list process, and it's just a huge burden, frankly, to make that work. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. And I appreciate, again, the author bringing this bill forward.
Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify on this?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Just state your name for the record and begin.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Erica Moss. I am the executive director of an organization called Parent Aware for School Readiness. We're the successor organization to the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, or MELF, which I know many members worked on and supported, and I appreciate that. I'm here today to speak with some concern about this bill. I support the provisions about the evaluation. But from our perspective, Pathway 2 is not working, and we have some concerns. This application process that's happening, that the requirement that providers actually engage families in an application process so that parents actually understand that they're receiving scholarship funds, is an important part of parent engagement and parent empowerment that MELF envisioned possible in a strong scholarship program. If some of the business and community leaders like Doug Baker, Ecolab CEO, Art Rolnick, Mike Cerisi, or some of these folks who've been involved in this, invested their personal time and money over time, were here before you today, they would talk about the promise of the scholarship program, and that promise being in large part rooted in parent engagement and empowerment. I could tell you that I wouldn't have had to even prepare talking points for them, as I often do on other subjects. They could sit before you and sort of wax eloquently for quite a while about things like empowering parents through the choice of a scholarship provider, about scholarship funds following a child when a family's circumstances change or they need to find a new provider, about creating a system where all providers have an equal opportunity to serve children with scholarships. These are characteristics that are expected to make a key difference in the outcomes of this program, and few of these characteristics exist in the so-called Pathway 2 scholarships. In the $20 million MELF pilot, we found that effective parent engagement required both giving parents information and also giving them resources to act on information. Those scholarships reached a very diverse, low-income population of parents, nearly all of whom reported an easy program selection process using star ratings to make informed choices. We heard anecdotes of Head Start parents dropping their kids off early and perceiving their attendance at Head Start differently because they had this scholarship to support their child's learning. I could go on, but the point is the same. Scholarships are about more than simply a way to allocate resources to providers. If the wish is to implement a program consistent with MELF's recommendations and research findings, I would ask that the committee consider whether this bill is consistent with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hilden, are you
testifying? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nancy Hilden, and I am here today on behalf of the Mini Minds Coalition. We actually are very pleased with the bill in its original form, and we're delighted to see this bill introduced. I think everyone knows that when you are spending public dollars on programs, and they are new programs, you need to be accountable back to the folks around this table as to what's happening, what's working well, and what isn't. The amendment does give us some pause. If you recall, you know, there's really several flavors of scholarships that have been tested out already in Minnesota. There were the early federal Early Learning Race to the Top grants that went to four regions in the state: St. Paul, Minneapolis, Pasca, and Whiter. Those were very flexible and seemed to be applied in a way that was quite ideal from the perspective of folks that were the technical experts at Mini Minds. Now we have Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 scholarships that are being implemented by the state. The idea, and we worked very hard with the schools last year and other groups that are already quality providers. And the idea behind Pathway 2 was really, if you're a quality provider for early child learning and you have demand, you know that there's a waiting list in your county, at your school, at your door, that we wanted to encourage those quality providers to actually expand the number of slots. That's not possible if you only get one scholarship. You can't hire a teacher. You can't finance another classroom. So the idea behind Pathway 2 was to give sufficient quantity and assurance of scholarship recipients out of that waiting list to actually be able to do something to create more quality slots. So far, and we're not even a year into implementation, so far we're hearing that that's a bumpy road with how that's being implemented. And I think I've heard from Mr. Kerr, from Tom Holton, from other schools, from Mr. Grathwall is never shy about letting concerns be known. And I think I've committed to everybody that we very much want this to work in the way that it was intended. We have sat down and talked about what some of these concerns are. Nobody wants to, I don't want to do a 9-page application for anything. Nobody wants that. And so we want to make the process better. But what I would encourage you to think about is simply to not support backtracking to what's comfortable. So going back to state aid, because that's comfortable and known, rather than just making the adjustments necessary. And we know, I think that Mr. Carter has heard a lot at MDE about some of these concerns and is making great strides in improving the process so that we actually address many of the concerns that the school has come forward. And I've also committed to Representative Newton that we want to work through the interim to really make this scholarship process work. What is different and unique about scholarships compared to state aid is it's not perfect, but it is a starting point for getting the parents engaged. What we want is to see the parents starting to be exposed to that learning environment that their kids are in. Sometimes it's a very unusual environment even for them. And so the process of getting them engaged is really important. And that doesn't come if it's just an easy formula state aid. We know we have under state aid formulas a pretty atrocious track record right now on achievement gap. So if we just go back to what's comfortable and normal for one provider of early education, I would contend that that's just not moving us forward. I'm not saying that to be critical at all of schools, because schools are critical to our important piece of what we need to have to be successful with early learning. They need to be part of that. Their infrastructure is really good, and they're really good at helping kids. And frankly, it's pretty convenient for parents too. So this is not to say that the process can't be better. I would just strongly urge you to really think hard about trying to take away some of the pieces that out of the scholarship that might really be effective and good going forward. And let's work on making the process really better. And you have my commitment from here on out to really sitting down and rolling up sleeves to make that better.
Is there anybody else in the audience to testify in this bill? Okay, then we have Representative Breinert's the first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd actually like to hear from the Department of Education on the issues that have been raised here at the table.
He's coming down. State your name, position, and then... Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Darren Corey. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you, Representative Breinert, for asking us to come up and testify on kind of what was said. I think an important piece of the discussion that really wasn't, that I didn't hear when the testifiers were testifying are the regional scholarship administrators that are in place. And I think that's kind of what Representative Newton's amendment is trying to get at. But the way that the Pathway 2 scholarships work are the commissioner under the statutory language that was passed last session created the Pathway 2 scholarships that and basically under the formula that was used to determine those scholarships, the districts were notified that they were eligible for a certain amount of scholarships. Once that happened, those districts went out into the community and found kids to fill those scholarships, which was, you know, how it was intended to work. And then they have those parents submit an application to the regional scholarship administrator, who then processes the payment. I wouldn't say that the process has been perfect on the MDE side. I wouldn't say that the process has been perfect on the district side. But I also think that the regional scholarship administrators, you know, they would probably admit that there's been some hiccups on their end, too. So it is a continuous improvement process. This is the first year that these scholarships have gone out. It's a brand new program. We are continuously working with the Mini Minds folks, with the districts, with the scholarship administrators to get these out in a more efficient fashion. I think what you'll see next year in the second year of the scholarships is that the Pathway 2 scholarships will be the districts are going to have a little bit more time to coordinate their efforts and get everything prepared in time for the start of the school year, which this year really wasn't possible just because of how the timing when the language was passed. So I think that just addresses some of the points that were brought up. But if there's specific questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so I'm hearing you say that this is the rocky road of new beginnings and that if we give it time, it's going to improve. I'm wondering if there's any specific recommendations the department has to streamline it so that we're in better shape when school starts next year and that dollars start rolling sooner.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Briner, I think, you know, we've heard a lot about the 9-page application. Just know, like, about 2 pages of that application is a Tennyson warning, and some of the reason why it's so long is also because of accessibility requirements. But that being said, we are doing everything we can to minimize the burden that are on parents for completing those applications. So that's something we're doing internally. Legislatively, I think, you know, what Representative Newton proposes here is an idea. I think we have, with the scholarship administrators, we have contracts in place with those folks. The money's already going out the door through those folks. So I'm not sure that with this, you know, effective date being immediately on this, that we might have some problems with that. I think that what we're trying to do is get everything out the door this first year and really work with districts to improve that process. And I think that to that extent, we're in agreement with the Mini Minds folks that we should really let this process play out and try and work through the implementation process as opposed to going back and making changes in statute.
Thank you. Representative Briner, do you have no? Okay. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much for the Department of Education, but just to state that I have difficulty with the amendment because the idea of scholarships was to move money into at-risk families, as was stated by one of the testifiers, and it wasn't meant to be cash flow to the schools. Yes, there's a good need for services that the schools provide, and yes, they need more money for those services, but this was not the path this was not the source of that cash flow that we intended through scholarships. So it should be bumpy road trying to do it through this so-called Pathways 2 because it was never meant for that. The bumpiness is not something that we just need to work out how to do it. The bumpiness is the fact that we shouldn't be doing it that way. It's meant for scholarships. It's not meant for pretend scholarship where you give money to the schools to do more services, which, like I say, they need. But this is not the one. And if the funds are following the child, that gives you the clue that it's not money to go to increase services in a school. It's supposed to follow the child wherever they go. I have concerns about Pathway 2, and I do not want to do anything that's supposed to makes more, puts into cement Pathways too.
Did you have any questions?
No, that was
okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I've worked with Mr. Kerr, who's our Director of Community Ed, for some 12 years, both on the Community Ed Advisory Council and then on the Anoka-Hennepin School Board. And that's what our ECFE program does. We reach out to at-risk families, and we've been doing it, and we've been very successful at it. It's just that this program came up, and, you know, as a general rule, I'm against institutionalization except when it comes to education. And I think that our schools are doing an excellent job.
Thank you. And Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would also say that I have serious concerns about the amendment. Section 116, or line 116 through 119, we've heard over and over and over again and over the last number of weeks that the application process is very lengthy and difficult. Wouldn't it be better to change the application process for everyone rather than just for this, for just certain programs? Representative Newton.
I think Mr. Kerr, yes. Is that Representative Newton? Do you want him to answer? Mr. Kerr?
Chair Mulry, excuse me. I'm going to try to dissect your question. I think the intent of the language as it's written is that programs that qualify for Pathways to Scholarships would use whatever qualifiers the state is establishing, the department is establishing for eligibility for students, and they would utilize the processes that they have as programs to enroll those children and provide the information to the State Department as to meeting those qualifications and eligibility. So that isn't just limited to school districts. That would be Head Start, child care programs, other programs also, if that's what your question is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton, I guess going on to the second page of your amendment, it talks about the direct payments of state aid. And I would agree with the comments of Ms. Moss and Ms. Heldon and Representative Lane. The whole idea behind the scholarships is to empower families, and this is, it really looks like it's empowering programs. Under this section, if a family is in a program and they leave, can they take their scholarship with them? Representative Newton?
Representative, or Mr. Kerr?
That, I think department staff could answer that perhaps better than I, but I, if I'm correct in my understanding, there is a remainder of the scholarship that stays behind with the program because, for example, if a family enrolls for, whatever, 2-3 weeks, there's a certain commitment that that program has to make financially and staffing or whatever to provide for that student. If the family picks up and leaves, there's a certain percentage of the dollars that can stay behind because of those costs the program has had, but the bulk of the scholarship would go with the family as they move.
Mr. Kirk, could we cut up and represent my... Due to the time, it's a great discussion, but I just received word that the author would agree to the chair... offering a reconsideration of the amendment, so why don't we save a lot of time and
okay.
vote for that?
Yeah. I was going to ask for a roll call and ask my members to vote no, so this is better.
The chair will move that we reconsider the adoption of the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Newton, back to your original bill, which
is a basic bill, Mr. Chair, that I think everyone agrees to. So I would encourage a yes vote.
I think that saved about a half. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Newton, Mr. Kerr, I just want to address the amendment that we just reconsidered, I guess. But just to kind of put a little bit of context in here, the Pathway 2 concept was developed as we were putting together the scholarship bill last year as a way to make the scholarship program work for schools, their need to plan, their need to hire folks to run the classrooms, to have space and so forth, in a way that is in some ways more structured and constrained than some child care centers or family child care providers in some ways. And it's there is merit in doing it that way, in my opinion, in providing that kind of method for school districts to be able to plan and have this work for them. And I'm very much aware of the concerns about the bureaucracy and kind of the repeated steps and so forth that it's taking to get this money out there. I'm not sure that I'm excited about this specific solution to just sort of do it automatically, but I do think it's important that we streamline this funding because there are people on the waiting list, there are families on the waiting list. That is a form of choice that is taking place for people to be on that waiting list, but I don't want to take entirely out of the equation the element of families knowing that they have a decision to make about where to use the scholarship. It is their choice, even if we recognize through these slots that a certain number of people are going to be there. So I guess my offer to you, Representative Newton and Mr. Kerr and anybody else, is to try to develop a way that would work for schools without entirely divorcing the Pathway 2 funds from the element of parents having a choice about where to take that scholarship. And I think we could get there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, yes, and we will work through the interim to come up with some answers. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newton. I think we're ready to vote. Okay, Representative Breinert renews her motion to that House File 2691 be re-referred to Education Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You could have saved us a half hour. Representative Allen. The chair will move House File 1106 and for that it be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. Representative Allen, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for hearing this bill, House File 1106. This is a bill that the proponents, it's a modest bill, and I just want to read here the mission of the advocates who are the proponents of this bill. And this bill basically is a part of a larger effort to move us towards building a child welfare system that is prevention-based and utilizes best practices and data, and that also reduces the need for child protection placements by helping families early when indicators of abuse and neglect first emerge. And I'll turn it over to the testifier to explain, make a case for why the bill is needed.
Just a minute. I think...
I'm sorry. We have to do the amendment.
Representative first. Allen, you offered the DE1 amendment, so the chair will... On the author's request to get it into the shape that the author wants, the chair will move the DE1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And Mr. Chair, the revised bill, the original sections have been deleted in entirety. And the revised bill requires counties to keep enough data on child maltreatment reports that they do not respond to or screen in order to identify multiple reports on the same child.
Thank you. And go ahead and state your name. And
Mr. Chair, my name is Rich Gehrman. I'm the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children. We're an advocacy group, and as Representative Allen indicated, we're advocating for improvements to the state's child welfare system, by which we mean child protection, foster care-related services. I have a handout. I'll just briefly summarize the reasons that we believe that this bill will be helpful. First of all, the overall picture is that from various sources we have information that children may be reported for child abuse numerous times before they kind of get over the threshold into the child protection system. And so this bill simply is an effort to try to get consistency in the way counties report that information so that when children are reported multiple times, it'll be possible to see it. We've worked this through with the Department of Human Services and also the County Association representing social services administrators. And the outcome of this will simply be a report that comes out monthly or quarterly, which shows the number of children, not any identifying information, but the number of children who have been reported in the last year, one time, two times, three times, et cetera. What we have in terms of data points that we are basing this on is, first of all, the legislative auditor did a report in 2012 that much of this legislation is based on, which indicated that counties have very widely varying practices in terms of how they keep information on cases that they don't respond to. Some keep some information, some keep other information, you know, some put it in sometimes, some other times. So this is just basically going back to what the Department of Human Services has suggested since the social service information system went live in around 1999, which is here's the information report and get it down to the minimum necessary for this purpose. Secondly, we just hear from mandated reporters across the state on a regular basis that kids are reported multiple times without county action, and that's a great concern. There is a chart on your handout which indicates that, on average, states across the country will screen in, or basically screen in means go out and either do an investigation or a more informal assessment. They'll screen in 62% of child abuse calls, and Minnesota is 28 or 29%. So we're fewer than half in terms of just going out to take a look and see whether there is an issue. And then there is one county, a small county, Carver, that does actually keep this exact information, and they have a list of how many children were reported, starting with one child reported 25 times. When you get down to how many children were reported 10 or 15 times, it's 30 or 40 kids in a particular year. So there's a lot of information which says we really ought to know how often children are reported multiple times so that we can begin to see those patterns, and if it's out of line, begin to, you know, to address that. So that's a summary. We do have some written testimony from a mental health professional, but we won't have testimony on that live at this point, and that's basically my summary.
Thank you. Is there any other testifiers from the audience? Any other testifiers? My understanding is that after a lot of negotiations back and forth, DHS, the Association of Counties, and the county attorneys are all okay with this bill at the present time. Is that correct?
As
amended.
Yes, as amended. And I believe Mr. Kengry is here in terms of the...
he's right there. Mm-hmm. Did you want to testify, Mr. Kengry? Huh? We're busy, true. Long as everybody's kumbaya, I don't think we... I'm sorry. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I guess, maybe. Under this new language that's being proposed, if, say, a couple was divorcing and one parent wanted to establish cause for custody or parenting time, and they repeatedly... filed complaints with social services alleging child abuse, and the county repeatedly screened those out as not being valid, would that data still be maintained for the 365 days under those circumstances?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mellon, I believe it would be, but I also know from research that the percentage of times when there's sort of an issue between parents is that feeds in these cases is around 1 or 2% based on the research. So it should not be enough to tip the balance. And also I think that at some point, and I've supervised child protection units, I think at some point basically you begin to address that situation and try to see what you need to do to get the situation to move on. But technically I think you're right that would happen. I just think it would be a very small number of cases.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Merlene,
can Mr. Kerber come down? I have some questions regarding the just the Department of Human Services piece, or if somebody from the department's able to testify.
I don't think this is Mr. Kerber's area, but somebody, is there somebody from the department that, okay.
Someone else I can put on the spot?
That's an awful big department. Go ahead and state your name and position.
My name is Marvin Davis. I currently work at the Department of Human Services in the Child Safety and Permanency Division.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And my question is on the lines 2.4 to 2.5. The Department of Human Services shall specify to the counties the minimum information needed to accomplish this purpose. And I guess the purpose is maintaining the data for 365 days. Can you give us any insight on what sort of minimum information would be required by the department and what they would tell the counties that they need to do as far as meeting that provision?
Mr. Chair, Davis,
representatives, my understanding is that we would be asking to record enough information such that we would be able to identify a repeat report. So that would be the name of the child and a narrative of the report concerning, you know, when the screeners received the call from the reporting source, what was the nature of the allegation at that point in time.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I guess I do have you know, I don't know if we can just say that it's only 1 or 2% of reports, because I think, unfortunately, when we're looking at family law and when people are going through a divorce, or if maybe custody and parenting time is already established and one of the parents wants to prove endangerment and try to get that determination changed, which is the legal standard in Minnesota, in order to change custody, you have to prove endangerment. I think, unfortunately, we do see some parents filing repeated reports with county social services alleging some sort of abuse when really nothing has taken place, and the county rightfully screens those out. But now it sounds like under this new language, they're going to be maintaining that data for, you know, at least a year. And then it's a year from every time they screen that out. So, I mean, it could be ongoing. And I do have a little bit of a concern with that, but maybe the author and I can work together before the bill heads to the next committee.
Okay.
So, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a question for one of the testifiers. Where do these reports come from?
Mr. Davis? Or
is it who Mr. Gierman?
Mr. Gierman?
Gierman?
Sure. Gierman.
G-E-H-R-M-A-N. Mr. Chair, representatives.
Mr. Davis.
Yes. Reports can come to the local child welfare agency from teachers, from doctors, from therapists, from neighbors, from concerned citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm having a problem with the same, kind of the same concerns that Representative Moline has shared. A disgruntled neighbor makes accusations or says comments or makes a report, and there's no validity to it, and yet these continue to remain, even though they've been checked out and there's not a problem. Those would remain there for 365 days, even though they've been checked out and there was no remaining concerns. Can you elaborate on that, Representative Allen?
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair. I'm not, plumbing is not my area, but I would think that the best interests of the child standard would govern in family proceeding, and so that if there were these reports, I'm sure there would be potential for other, you know, that the court's going to only view the evidence that's relevant. So I'm not sure that I think it were that the interest in collecting this data outweigh that that the courts could adequately protect the parents in that proceeding. That would be my answer.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would appreciate more information on that. So there is a report that is made, and the county investigates it and finds out that they don't need to take any action, but we want to keep that information there to see if there's a whole bunch of them, but if individually when the county looks at it and they say there's no reason to follow up on it, why do we need to keep that information for 365 days if that individual reports show that there isn't merit?
Mr. Davis?
Yes, Mr. Chair, representatives, my interpretation of your question, I'll try to offer an answer. With the language in this bill as it stands, my interpretation is that there is a desire to maintain data within the local agency on a report that was received, that was screened out. So this is not the same situation, in my understanding, where the report was made, it met the criteria, and someone went out to do the follow-up sort of like assessment or investigation with the family. My understanding is that this bill is just requiring the local agencies to keep this minimum set of data for subsequent reports that may come in on that family. And so I think back to the other question with regards to, you know, a matter between spouses, if these reports do not result in any additional action, that's going to be data that's maintained just within that agency. Hopefully that answers your question.
Mr. Chair, testifier, would you define screened out, please, for me?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, representatives, in the state of Minnesota, we have what are known as screening guidelines.
Okay.
And these screening guidelines are consistent with Minnesota Section 626-556 in terms of what constitutes physical abuse, what constitutes neglect, what constitutes sexual abuse, and things of that nature. And so we have screening guidelines with the idea that we can have uniformity in the reports that are accepted throughout the state. And so let's say we're here in Ramsey County, so let's say that a report comes into Ramsey County from a school social worker who's got a concern about a child who comes to school dirty every day, and they will give the screeners all of the information that they have available to them. The screeners will make a determination as to whether or not that report meets their criteria for developing the case, you know, taking all of the information related to the name of the child, name of the parents, where they live, and so forth, and then assign that case to have someone go out and do a follow-up. Now, when a report is screened out, that screener makes a determination that the report itself does not meet that statutory criteria that is related to, you know, neglect or the different forms of abuse. And so getting back to this bill, it's my understanding that what Mr. Gierman would like to have happen is for the agency to say, okay, that report did not meet our criteria, but we're going to hang on to a little bit of information about this family such that any subsequent report that may come in on that child or a member of that family, that agency will have some knowledge of this family, whereas if they simply screen it out and don't retain any information, there will not be, I don't know, a pattern of concerns that have been made by individuals, whether they're mandated to report or not, with regards to that specific child or that family.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one more question to the testifier again? So what effort is made to find out if a report is legitimate, if it's valid, or if it's coming from somebody who just doesn't like the family or a disgruntled neighbor, and then that's held against the family?
In my experience,
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair and representatives, in my experience, I used to work in child protection, when that report comes in, it may be accepted on its face because it meets the criteria, or there may be a need to do some follow-up information. And so the screeners, you know, if they feel like it warrants additional information, they can ask some follow-up questions, or they can ask for medical documentation, or they can ask for some additional information that will inform them whether or not the report meets the criteria. So I guess what I'm trying to say to you is that even though a call may come in, it's not always an automatic yes or an automatic no.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question. I remember a case. I practiced family law a lot for 14 years, and I remember a case in a metro county where, on a custody battle, where the one spouse claimed the other spouse was drunk and hit the kids a lot. Custody investigator did an investigation and reported that that happened a lot. In the end, there was a lot of other witnesses that said that was totally false, and the judge was smart enough to totally ignore the custody report from the county employee, which we found out, I found out from the other attorney 2 years later, was totally false, and they had set it up, the one spouse and the custody investigator, before she filed for divorce. How that would be still on the record then, wouldn't it, against this guy that was on the other side, that the report was said he was this terrible person, or wouldn't that be unkept then?
Mr. Chair, in the scenario that you've provided, I did not hear that the case was accepted and was assessed or investigated to make a determination whether or not there was any truth to the allegation, you know, and so I'm not really able to speak.
Well, you say it wasn't investigated. The custody investigator for the county is the one that wrote the report and said that all these things happened, and found that they had happened, which was all false. How, I don't see what you're saying that there was no report accepted.
I'm not sure if the custody evaluation happened independently of a child maltreatment report, or if the report itself ever came to Child Protection for the investigation. I do know that in some instances, in cases like the scenario that you've provided, that those cases may not ever come to Child Protection, and maybe, you know, the judge may appoint the evaluator to do that evaluation and do the fact-finding and get to the bottom of it. And so had the case been reported to Child Protection, and, you know, I think that it sounds like there would have been a pretty good chance that that case would have been accepted, well, then the assessment would have occurred. If the child was old enough to give a coherent statement, they would have been interviewed. Both parents would have been interviewed. Anybody else with additional information pertinent to the case would have been contacted and interviewed during this process, you know, that the workers will go through before they would, you know, make a finding or a determination as to whether or not something happened.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier. So you brought this bill before us so that counties can track the number of times children are reported for maltreatment. So what would be the expectation of the counties if there are repeated reports?
Who do you want to ask? German?
Yes.
Mr. German.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, this is a bill. One thing I do want to clarify is that this information is already being reported. It's just being reported differently by different counties. And so we're just trying to get some clarification about what it is they should report. And many counties keep this information indefinitely. Some keep it for 4 years. So it just provides a lot of clarity. Then the purpose of the bill is simply to be able to identify. This is all de-identified information, and it's before, by definition, is before anybody actually does an investigation or gets in the record or anything of that nature. We're just trying to get enough data to see if kids are often being reported 5, 10, 15 times, and that raises some flags in terms of are the standards that the Department of Human Services have actually being followed. And so the information that we have from a number of sources is that the reason that there are so many children who are being reported multiple times is because the counties and the state are not pursuing the same standards, and kids who actually do rise to the level they ought to be screened in, which is the next step after this legislation, aren't getting services from Child Protection. I think the legislative auditor report did find that there are very widely varying standards across the state for what kind of counts as child abuse and neglect, and this is kind of a step towards getting some clarification to those standards. I also would say, just in response to one other question, 70% of reports, roughly, and if this is off, you know, please let me know, Mr. Davis, but come from mandated reporters, and so only 30% come from community, family members, et cetera. And most of those mandated reporters are trained, and they're not going to be making nuisance calls. So the number, when you really boil it down, that come from kind of spousal, you know, kind of, you know, arguments and so forth, is relatively small. I think it's a much greater concern that children are reported 5, 10, 15 times, and we don't know what happens to them. So this is just an easy way to kind of start seeing when patterns are out of line.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Moran.
So I was just thinking, you know, it's good to track and see how many times there's been repeated reports, but the legislature just spent a lot of dollars for PSOPs. Right, to do some intervention, to offer some support to parents who have been who've been screened out, you know. And my thought was that anytime we see or reports coming in 2, 3, 4, 5 times, and there have not been any PSOP dollars spent towards to support that family, then I think there's a bigger piece that's missing within the Department of Human Services. So, which is my question is, what would be the expectation if we were to see this happening? Because there need to be some intervention there.
Mr. Gurman.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, several things. I'm sorry that our testifier wasn't able to be here today. She's ill, but if you read her testimony, she essentially is in a program that deals with PSOP, which is a parent support outreach program, supposedly serving parents that don't quite, situations that don't quite rise to the level of abuse and neglect. But what she is finding in her program, and that her written testimony talks about, is that cases which really are fairly high risk situations that ought to be screened in for child protection are being diverted to PSOP. And so, just as an example, she told me about a colleague last week where a little girl reported that her mother had hit her sister with a 2x4, broken her arm. Okay. It had been 10 days, it had been referred, and it was referred to this voluntary parent support outreach program instead. And she has another example in her written testimony. So we think the issue is that many situations really do rise to the level of abuse and neglect and ought to get a child protection response are not getting that response. And so the purpose of this bill is just really to see those patterns de-identified and be able to see when counties are kind of out of line and have too many cases that just keep coming in again and again and again. So this does not get into personal data. This is not, no one's going to see this. It's really, kind of summary data to show patterns that we are seeing in our, from mandated reporters talking to us and from this federal data that I provided you on that chart, which indicate that there are way too many kids who are being repeatedly reported without any action.
Thank you. Representative Moran?
No, yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to turn our attention back to the child instead of worrying about the parents. I think we should try to err more on the side of the child who may well be abused or neglected. I understand that perhaps some counties find it easier to just, they don't have to attend to these cases, my understanding. They can just say, well, it doesn't rise to that level and pass it over. But finally, you find a case where you find this little girl whose arm has been broken by a 2x4 by her mom, and you go, holy cow, and you look back and you go, well, you know, we've received a number of reports on this. Let's really move in on this now. We just need the counties to be aware, keeping track of the circumstances, even if they don't move on it, because there is nothing that says a county has to move on it, is my understanding. So we just are just asking them to just keep track of it so that if something comes down where you cannot ignore it anymore, you know how big a case you're actually dealing with. We are not putting parents in any situation here. You could have a list of 25 of them, and if there's no problem, there's no problem. It has no effect on parents anywhere, anytime, child custody, anything. It's just a list. But if it actually is a situation of neglect and abuse, we need to assist that child. That child has nobody but us.
Mr. Gurman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, did you want a response to that? Sure. Well, I think that is really the point of this, is that we have a lot of information to the effect that children who are in pretty serious circumstances are repeatedly being reported and no one is even going out to take a look. But in order to get some discipline into that process, then we need to have information that says, how many times is this happening? And that's all this bill does, is figure out how many times there are multiple reports on kids, so that from a management point of view, you can begin to zero in and say, okay, is there an issue here? That's as far as this bill goes. And again, it does not result in a situation where any information becomes public or there's a finding of abuse and neglect or anything of that nature. This is strictly to try to see the pattern of children who need child protection services not receiving it.
Representative Lane, did you have any further?
That's fine.
Okay. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, since the counties and DHS will be maintaining new and different, more information on very sensitive allegations, it seems this should go to civil law.
Well, Representative Myra, we're not sure on that, and the Human Services policy can send it to civil law. If it should go to civil law, it can go, that can be decided later. We haven't received a request. And so, basically, I think we should send it to Health and Human Service policy. We know it has to go there. And then in the meantime, before it gets there, it can be decided whether it goes to civil law or not, and they can talk to the chair and find out more about that. So was that the only, that's all? Okay. Don't see any more questions or discussion. Okay. The chair renews his motion that House File 1106, as amended, be re-referred to Health and Human Services Policy. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Mullery will move that House File 2921 be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. Representative Mullery, would you like to discuss your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically, to cut short what we went through this on both the St. Paul Promise neighborhoods and the Minneapolis Northside Achievement Zone, and Sandra Samuels and I can't think of Munir's first name. Oh, that's his first name, right? Munir? sorry. Bruce, yes. Bruce Munir. Sorry. And we have substitutes today for them. I know Sandra had a meeting with Hennepin County on part of the program there. And so basically the purpose of this bill is to set up a system where we would have other zones like that. So there wouldn't be just the NAS and the Promise in St. Paul, but other ones around the state. And this would create a program where the department could set up to 8 zones. I think that would be plenty for the next at least 2, 3, 4 years. California is in the process of doing this, and Florida's done it. Actually, in Florida, this, I'm not sure if I want to carry the bill, because in Florida, the author of the bill was Marco Rubio. it's worked very well in Florida, and I think it's just starting to be put in process in California, this type of a system. And we have two is there a third witness? Just two witnesses today. And so I'd like to call on them.
All right, please state your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Andre Dukes. I am the Director of Family Academy for the Northside Achievement Zone. I'm also a resident of North Minneapolis and a pastor in the community as well. And so I represent the community today. Want to preface our comments today by saying that we're not experts on the details of the House File 2921 Success for All legislation, but we come to you as leaders of the Northside Achievement Zone, which is one of two promised neighborhoods in the state of Minnesota along with St. Paul. This bill follows a similar model that is proving to be effective in our North Minneapolis community and on others around the country. And I will certainly speak to that, but you are likely to have questions that we can't answer today. But we are committed to working to find all answers that we can and quickly provide the information that we can to you. Now I'd like to share with you why the model proposed in House File 2921 is so important and why this would be incredibly beneficial in communities throughout the state. This bill offers the opportunity to change the outcomes for the most at-risk, or I like to say high-return, families and children in our state. This is a clear path for the state to partner with on the ground community-based organizations to get outcomes that we've never seen before. The Promised Neighborhoods offers three things. Number one, a relentless focus on results that aligns the vision and resources of the partnerships to the communities most pressed with to their most pressing challenges. Number two, a mechanism for accountability that ensures all partners are dedicating time and resources toward the desired outcomes in a process that is transparent to the entire community. And number three, a diverse representation across multiple sectors, including residents, civic leaders, policymakers, and local funders. Every community across the state is different, and this legislation offers an opportunity to work in much more effective ways to improve the well-being of families and children. We already know that there is great interest across the state in the Promised Neighborhood model. The Promised Neighborhood provides us with a list of those who submitted an intent to apply, and they include Little Earth, United Tribes, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, United Way of Greater Duluth, Itasca Community College, Mesabi Range Community, and Technical College, and many more. We do have a full list of those if you would like for us to hand them out. I'd just like to say that as a part of the National Promised Neighborhoods, we have had an opportunity to go around to all of the initial grantees that received the Promised Neighborhoods money. And one of them was in Berea College, which is in Kentucky, just outside of the Appalachian Mountains. And they serve families within an area that is spread miles apart. We also visited Haywood, California, which is centered around schools there, as well as Buffalo, which is literally ran by a bank. And what I want to say is that none of the states that are currently doing this work have the type of structure that we have, where we have 150 different schools represented in our zone. But we are being looked at around the country as a model for how this work needs to be done. And so we definitely want you to consider this legislation so that we can continue this great work on behalf of the children of our state and our country.
Thank you. And did you say your last name was Dukes?
Dukes.
D-U-K-E-S. Yes. Like the Duluth Dukes.
All right.
And I wanted just wanted to clarify. We don't want to set up one model. We want to make sure that the commissioner, you know, allows different types of approaches to this from different parts of the state, because each part of the state is probably a little different, and what might work in one place wouldn't work as well in the other place.
And is that a part of the bill?
Yes.
Okay. In light of the time, and because we have heard from the NNAS and the Promised Neighborhood, so we understand the concept, and this is just moving on to Ed Finance, and we'll provide a structure for the commissioner to consider I'm wondering if we can wrap this up really quickly here, not necessarily hear a lot more testimony and get on to our other bill so that we can adjourn on time.
That's fine with me.
So if the other testifier could just sort of summarize her statement.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Jamie Boning, and I'm the Education Director for Northside Achievement Zone. The point of me testifying is just to say we're already seeing outcomes materialize in North Minneapolis. And while we had a model to operate off of out in the Harlem Children's Zone, we have our own model in which we tweaked, and they have $100 million. We have about $5 million a year. We had to be a little creative about how we're doing it, but our outcomes have been phenomenal so far. So today we operate as one system of supports for more than 600 families with 1,500 children. We have over 30 partners that are partnering with us, including 9 anchor schools, 8 out-of-school time programs that are providing accelerated academic results. And we're beginning to see the needle move in significant ways. And so we've provided you each with a copy of our current outcomes that were just approved today by Wilder. A couple of our highlights, particularly, is the participation in our Family Academy, which Mr. Dukes here runs. 77% of our active participants self-reported that they were proficient at the end of the session based on the content test, compared to 24% of a control group that we were operating at the same time. Our NAS scholars have been more likely to begin kindergarten, with 59% of NAS enrolled scholars being prepared for kindergarten, as opposed to 35% zone-wide. And then we had one of our greatest proof points is that the rate of NAS enrolled scholars proficient in reading and math increased by a rate of 52% in 2013, as demonstrated by our progress monitoring measures. And I don't want to go through all the proof points, but those are some incredible, in my history in education, these have been overwhelming proof points to me that when you bring together a collective group of partners who are committed to results and transparency and the willingness to say, we haven't been successful so far. We have the second highest achievement gap in the country for African American students. We have the highest achievement gap in the country for Latino and American Indian students. Those things to me are absolutely unacceptable, and I think the different models that would come up with the communities that have proposed alternative models are not just a nice to have, but a need to have in order to not be coming in last in a lot of the measures that we have in education right now.
All right, thank you. And in light of the time, I'm thinking that we'll just hear from Representative Myra, and hopefully we can move on from there.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, and to the testifiers, how are the high-risk zones identified? We have two right now, the innovation zones. How would the additional ones be identified?
There's some, basically, Mr. Chair and Representative Myra, there's a few, some criteria in, I can think of more after this was put together. I've heard a lot of different ones we would be discussing, and the commissioner would do that as to what it would be. But as I said before, I don't think that any one area of the state, I think it will depend on where in the state and what population it is. So the factors that are contributing to kids not being successful in a certain part might be different from factors in another one, and so I think you have to some extent leave that up to the department, just like the feds don't have, you know, specific things there. There's a huge difference, for instance, between the Northside Achievement Zone and the White Earth Zone. And so the way you factor with what becomes a zone has to have different factors, just as the approaches that the organizations take in each zone will have to be different depending on those type of factors that are in that area.
And Representative Mullery, I believe that Subdivision 4, Part B, has a list of criteria to be used.
And those are just some suggestions for the commissioner, and it's hope that the commissioner will come up with many more. And I've, ever since then, I've heard of other ones that I think should be in there. So.
Okay. Madam Chair,
yes,
may I ask one more question to the testifiers? Madam Chair,
yes,
may I ask one more question to the testifiers? Could you just elaborate on how parents are involved and empowered?
Absolutely. I facilitate an 8-week course in personal empowerment, and families come and they talk about understanding their core value. They talk about how to eliminate barriers that may prohibit them from meeting their goals. We have had a lot of families that have testified that they've come off of addictions, moved into, you know, employment, meaningful employment, and really as a result of building not only their own personal empowerment, but making community connections within our program, they have found themselves being able to meet many of the goals that they set for themselves and for their children, and they are more engaged once we really get to the school age, in terms of we built another curriculum that really gives them the skills to engage with the teachers in the schools, and so they feel much more empowered by doing that and going through the 8-week curriculum that we've offered.
And if I may just add two more layers to it, each of our families is assigned a connector, which is a family coach, that helps them create a family achievement plan in which they identify their own goals. And so they engage with the connector to come up with specified individualized steps for reaching those goals. At the core of what we do is that families are leaders, and so families identify their own solutions within evidence-based practices. What's nice is within our partners, they also want to empower families as leaders, and so access to our schools, families have greater access to our principals in order to come in and identify needs within the school, as well as learn about how they should engage as parents. And so across the spectrum, they're learning a lot of skills in the Family Academy. They're working alongside a connector. Our leaders at each of our partners is identifying NAS families for priorities because they're receiving these other supports and tend to follow through on their other commitments a little bit more, as well as the opportunity to have academic navigation, which is direct support for scholar achievement planning with their scholars as well. So a plethora of opportunities and supports along the way with families leading their own solutions.
Thank you, Ms. Bonney. Let's have a vote on this now and re-refer it. Representative Mulry renews his motion to re-refer it to the Committee on Education Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and we'll move on with our last bill as quickly as we can.
Okay. The chair will bring back from laying it over. What number?
2115.
That's right. House file 2115. We won't be voting finally on this tonight because of the 24-hour rule, and it's my understanding from Representative Meyer that you don't want to go ahead. It is a lengthy amendment, so I think that's okay. And so, but I do want to take the testimony on it, explain the amendment, and I believe there's an agreement, so hopefully we can get that quickly, and then our chair will again lay it over and bring it up for a vote tomorrow. So, Representative Clark, Mr. Kerber, in the interest of speed, can you just go up? Oh, okay, there's Representative Clark. We'll be a little informal to get this going fast. We're not going to vote tonight. We have a 24-hour rule. It wasn't waived by the members, and so I'm going to take testimony and then we'll lay it over and vote tomorrow. So could you both explain
yes,
the bill as what I'll do is I've brought it back. Both of you are in agreement with the, is this the DE2 amendment? Okay, for the purpose of getting it in the shape that the author wants, the chair will move the DE2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay, now Why don't you explain what the bill will be that we'll be voting on tomorrow?
I will, Mr. Chairman, and I want to apologize to you for not getting this.
But you will have to show up, both of you, to answer if there's questions after they get to understand it.
I just wanted to apologize to the committee for not getting this earlier. I was sick yesterday, and when I came today, we got it taken care of as quickly as we could, and so that's why it didn't make the 24-hour rule. So it's my fault. But I'm really happy to have this before you, Mr. Chairman. The bill has really two parts, or maybe three. First part, on page one, we've moved up to the front, which is on line 120 to 121, which basically suspends the rule that was going to be taking effect this July for two more years. And the reason for that is that's a rule that has to do with it's called the 50% rule, and it's a rule that has to do with the numbers of families and parents that are in a child care center working there when with more than 50% of the children. It's a rule that has a lot of difficulties when you have very large families. And the reason this bill is before us in general is because of the cultural differences that are brought to our community and the child care community by very large families, such as the Somali families, some of the other culturally specific groups, too. So we suspend that rule from going into effect for 2 years while we do two things. The first thing is on line 122, we do a child care professional development pilot project. Well, this is not a totally new idea, but it is a way to try to help the folks that are dealing with providing excellent service in the child care community for, again, specifically large families and new to this country, new Americans, to get training and education and mentoring, in-service training, coursework, and so on, to help them really come up to par with what our child care system looks like. And we run through the language there. We would have a pilot project that includes at least four child care centers, two in the metro area and two in greater Minnesota. And the idea then is to provide a career ladder for folks who are starting out at the very lowest part of the service of the employment in these child care centers. We've tried this in the past, and it works. People start out as child care assistants, can progress with some training and education, classes and so on, up to a higher level of employment. It does work. And so we're going to institute that with this particular group of folks and make sure that we can report back the evaluation of that. I know it will be good because we have done it in the past, but we haven't done it for a few years now. And it's been something that didn't continue to keep getting funded. On line 2.22, direction to the commissioner, this was the result of some very good negotiations that we did today. And when I say we, I mean members of the Somali community who are involved in child care provisions, services, and the people from the Department of Human Services, including Mr. Kerber, several others. We talked about what is it that we could do to make the situation work with our the cultural differences that come as a result of new Americans getting into this field. And we decided that there were several things we wanted to do. First of all, we wanted to look at, on line 2.25, the economic impact of enforcing this 50% rule. What does that actually do to the community? Number two, the cultural assets of the existing East African child care center models. One of the things that was said over and over is, what we're talking about here is a different model than we see in some of our other child care centers, and we should understand why it works. There should be a document that you have that says, report shows Somali kids test kindergarten ready. Why do you all have that? Okay. So, I mean, that's one of the things that we know. There's definitely some assets that are going on in this kind of child care center and training, and we want to understand that more and understand what it could mean to our Department of Human Services and to other models. And number three, the educational achievement record of children participating in the existing models. Again, that's that article refers to that. But number four, the jobs and job advancement opportunities created for parents who are active in this model. And then the last part is the commission reports these findings and an evaluation back to the members of the committees that are concerned. Mr. Chairman, members, the idea is that we need to understand that there are some differences. There's some cultural differences that are operating here with large families, with the way that child care is done, and we need to understand both the positives and the negatives and try to give it a chance to see if we can make some adjustments in the future. There's several people who would like to testify from the community, but I think you wanted to hear from Mr. Kerber first.
we want to hear from Mr. Kerber, and I don't know that we're already over time. And so, Mr. Kerber, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Human Services, and I'll be brief. I think we've expressed to the committee before with the original bill, there was a repealing of the 50% rule that we talked about. And in this bill, we're thankful to Representative Clark's work on this and Representative Kahn, in that it's pushing the date out. It's extending that effective date another 2 years rather than repealing it, and that's much better, and we can live with that. The part that also goes along with that, having an actual review of this situation in some detail, we think makes a lot of sense. It will cost, but it's not in the governor's budget, I need to say that. but the notion that there will be a review in particular of some of the jobs and the job placement opportunities created for parents on Parent 4 Online 2.30. Our concern is whether or not these are always meaningful jobs. We really respect the fact that there are some unique characteristics to East African community, and the large families present a different challenge than is present for a lot of the child care situation. We recognize that. And we also recognize that it's certainly wonderful that parents are involved in their children's education, involved in their child care, and they're partnering with their teachers. The struggle we have is whether or not that's work, and we should pay for that as work in our public programs. And if it is work, then it's a struggle for us to say that then it's child care, because the parents are there with the children. But nevertheless, given that, this pushing that effective date out 2 years is far better than repealing it, and the study, I think, with the report back, is going to give us a lot more sort of solid information for the next time we talk about this, about this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. You mean for once the legislature and the state agency wants to actually have facts before we make decisions, finally? what a strange thing. I want to thank Representative Clark, Representative Kahn, and Mr. Kerber for really working on this. I think, as I expressed last week, I think this is a good solution. And do members want to hear a lot of testimony, or do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay. I hate to keep people. We're not going to vote on it, so I'm going to lay it over, but we can take testimony then.
I think I'd ask Mr. Hashi and maybe Africa, and just to come down. These are some folks who've been involved. Mr. Hashi's been involved in the negotiations from the very beginning, so he might indicate his thoughts about this. And then I've just met Africa, who's one of the child care providers, and she might want to just share a little bit about her.
Let me first ask, is there anybody in the audience that wants to object to the proposed agreement? Doesn't look like it. Okay, Mr. Hashi. Would you state your name and spell it, and then go ahead.
My name is Mahmoud Hashi, Mohamud Hashi, Hashi, from New American Business Association.
Okay, go ahead.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. We are very pleased to come before you in support for the amendment. We came last week here, and as Karen has mentioned earlier, we are in negotiation with the Karen and the DHS, and we have agreed to look at the impact, economic impact of the 50%. We believe we can all of us study the impact of the 50%, and if we review once we review that and we find the result, we can based on that finding. We believe that it's we are a unique community, and all the centers that we have. When you look at the school readiness, the finding that we have just mentioned earlier, school readiness that has gone up, employment has gone up, among the community. So it is a unique community which has large family size. So it's a good idea, and we support the amendment of the HF 211.5, and we are in support. And my next slide is one of the examples that the positive side of this, she can state her experience.
Okay, state your name and...
My name is Saada Isir, but everybody know me as Africa. That's my nickname. So I'm going to talk about the positive side about the daycares. We were one of the first daycare open in 2008, and I can consider us like we are the lead in that aspect. So nowadays, we have three Somali daycares who get the accreditation last year. And also, yesterday, I was thinking what I come in front of the committee what to tell you about what we accomplished. I count how 20 ladies that accomplished the CDA, Child Development Associate. That's accreditation that every mom will come a teacher. This job is a professional job. First, when I go to that field, I thought about it, and I say how this lady will come become, the families will become a... So I have one of my ladies with me here. She started as a janitor, and then after that she was aid. She got her first aid and CPR, all that stuff the state required us to get to come to be with the children. After that, now she accomplished the CDA, the Child Development Associate. It's a national accreditation. It comes from Washington, D.C. It's not only in Minnesota. And I can give that report to the DHS if they want to see anything accomplished with it. I can give them the 20 names, ladies who get the child development. They can work in Head Start. They can find another job. They also, some of them that their husband with the economic was bad, that they are working for the, to support that family. We all came from a large family. This community came. I've been with 10 children, like we have 9 siblings. Myself, I have 5 kids. The minimum Somali women have 5 kids. So you can understand if I make 50%, I can fire like 30 children will be but only 5 moms, you know, and the other 5 will go away. So that's how it's affecting us. It's not only the Somali community, all East African community, all Somali community. Maybe they are not with us, but they give me their voice. They told me, go to the chairman and talk to them about and representative and tell them how we are. And we are like, how the bill is coming. I wish it was reserved, but if the DHS is asking us how we accomplish what we're doing difference, if we give these trainings for the newcomers, new daycare centers, we're willing to do. The first daycares will open now. We've been 8 years, but people who are just opening, they don't get training. They don't know how to do the bills. They don't know how to hire. And when I see the DHS also, if they can, like the pyramid also, they're worrying about the, what's the job, what's the criteria, you know? If they give them, like tell them what's the pyramid, they working, who's working in this position and all that stuff. And thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. We'll take one more, but very short.
Yeah.
State your name. And
good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Marianne Yusuf. I'm a teacher at Medina Academy. I didn't know anything about the children then. And when I started, I have only high school diploma. Then I got the opportunity. I was a mom, 5 kids. Then I, working with young children, I decided, you know, to learn more about the children, about child development. Then Medina Academy, they give me opportunity. They sent me to school. They pay me my school. As you know, it's very hard, you know, to be a mom and working at the same time. Then, and I get that opportunity. And I was a very hard work mom. Then I got my CDA. Then I was so proud of to get my dream alive. I always, as a mom, I love to help my children as well as other children in my community. I start working when I get the Mercedes. I start working at preschool age. Then also I work toddler age. Now I'm even a teacher. And also,
Yeah, today at the county, I'm not eligible to daycare. So now I'm working as a teacher, professional teacher. And when I had five children, when I have my fifth child, I start working Medina Academy. And my other children, when I was not working at childcare, and they start school ESL program until they fifth grade. But when I have my fifth child working with the Medina Academy, as working as a teacher, my fifth child, when she's starting kindergarten, she become a second grade reading and math. And when she's, they test her when she's getting a kindergarten started. And she was, where she go? I told her she went to preschool with Medina Academy. Then I'm so glad, you know, my two little children now, they don't need an ESL class. But my other all the children, three of them, they took that program. It took a long time, you know, to take an ESL class. So I'm going to thank that opportunity to the Americans, to the chairman, that I get that opportunity, and I want other mom to get that opportunity as well.
Okay, thank you. Is there any questions? Okay, then the chair will...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that.
Thank you. The chair will lay the bill over to tomorrow, and with that, the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.